Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
All right, well, good afternoon. We are going to be in basically Numbers 19, 20, and 21 today in the section called, the name for it's Chukat, named after a phrase just at the beginning part of this passage. It basically means statute of, and that's what we're going to be looking at, the statute of, starting out with the red heifer in chapter 19. And just to give you a preview of coming attractions, you may have been going through the book of Hebrews and seeing in chapter 9 they're passing reference to a heifer and wonder what that's all about. And this is what that's all about, what we'll be going over today. So, chapter 19 of Numbers. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe and Aharon, saying, "This is the statute of the law of the Lord has commanded, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, that they bring you an unblemished red heifer, in which is no defect, and on which a yoke has never been placed. You shall give it to Eleazar the priest, and it shall be brought outside the camp and be slaughtered in his presence. Next, Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood, and with his fingers sprinkle some of its blood toward the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. Then the heifer shall be burned in his sight, its hide and its flesh and its blood, with its refuse, shall be burned. The priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet material and cast it into the midst of the burning heifer. The priest shall then wash his clothes and bathe his body in water and afterward come into the camp. But the priest shall be unclean until evening. The one who burns it also shall wash his clothes in water and bathe his body in water and shall be unclean until evening. Now a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and deposit them outside the camp in a clean place. And the congregation of the sons of Israel shall keep it as water to remove impurity. It is purification from sin. The one who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. It shall be a perpetual statute to the sons of Israel and to the alien who sojourns among them. The one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days. That one shall purify himself from uncleanness with the water on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, and then will be clean. If he does not purify himself on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, he will not be clean. Anyone who touches a corpse, the body of a man who has died and does not purify himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel, because the water for impurity was not sprinkled on him, and he shall be unclean. His uncleanness is still on him. This is the law when a man dies in a tent. Everyone who comes into the tent and everyone who is in the tent shall be unclean for 7 days. Every open vessel which has no covering tied down on it shall be unclean. Also, anyone who is in the open field touches one who has been slain with the sword or has died naturally, or a human bone or a grave, shall be unclean for 7 days. Then the unclean person shall take some of the ashes of the burnt purification from sin and flowing water shall be added to them in a vessel. A clean person shall take hyssop and dip it in the water and sprinkle it on the tent and all the furnishings and the persons who were there, and on the one who has touched the bone or the slain or the one dying naturally or the grave. Then the clean person shall sprinkle on the unclean on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, and on the 7th day he shall purify himself from uncleanness. And he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and shall be clean by evening. But the man who is unclean and does not purify himself from uncleanness, that person shall be cut off from the midst of the assembly, because he has defiled the sanctuary of the Lord. The water for impurity has not been sprinkled on him. He is unclean. So it shall be a perpetual statute for them. And he who sprinkles the water for impurity shall wash his clothes, and he who touches the water for impurity shall be unclean until evening. Furthermore, anything that the person touches shall be unclean, and the person who touches it shall be unclean until evening. Chapter 20. Then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the seventh month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. There was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moshe and Aharon. The people thus contended with Moshe and spoke, saying, "If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? Why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us to this wretched place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink." Then Moshe and Aharon came in from the presence of the assembly to the doorway of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And the Lord spoke to them, saying, "Take the rod, and you and your brother Aharon assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beasts drink." So Moshe took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded. And Moshe and Aharon gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, "Now listen, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" Then Moshe lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. But the Lord said to Moshe and Aharon, "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. From Kadesh, Moshe sent messengers to the king of Edom. "Thus your brother Israel has said, 'You know all the hardship that has befallen us, that our fathers went down to Mitzrayim, and we stayed in Mitzrayim a long time, and the people of Mitzrayim treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out from Mitzrayim. Now behold, we are at Kadesh, a town at the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or through vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or the left, until we pass through your territory.' Edom, however, said to him, 'You shall not pass through us, or I will come out with a sword against you.' Again, the sons of Israel said to him, 'We will go up by the highway, and if my livestock do drink any of your water, I will pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else.' But he said, 'You shall not pass through.' And Edom came out against him with a heavy force, with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory. So Israel turned away from him. Now when they set out from Kadesh, the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to Mount Hor. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe and Aharon at Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom, saying, 'Aharon will be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land which I have given to the sons of Israel, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. Take Aharon and his son Eleazar and bring them up to Mount Hor, and strip Aharon of his garments and put them on his son Eleazar. So Aharon will be gathered to his people and will die there.' So Moshe did just as the Lord had commanded, and they went up to Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. After Moshe had stripped Aharon of his garments and put them on his son Eleazar, Aharon died there on the mountaintop. Then Moshe and Eleazar came down from the mountain. When all the congregation saw that Aharon had died, all the house of Israel wept for Aharon 30 days. Chapter 21. When the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atarim, when he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. So Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities." The Lord heard the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they were utterly destroyed them and their cities. And thus the name of the place was called Hormah. Then they set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. The people spoke against God and Moshe. "Why have you brought us up out of Mitzrayim to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food." The Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many people of Israel died. So the people came to Moshe and said, "We have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us." And Moshe interceded for the people. Then the Lord said to Moshe, "Make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard. And it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he will live." And Moshe made a bronze serpent and set it on a standard. And it came about that if a serpent bit any man, then he looked to the bronze serpent and lived. Now the sons of Israel moved out and camped at Obot. They journeyed from Obot and camped there at Zeboim, and in the wilderness which is opposite Moab to the east. From there they set out and camped at Wadi Zered. And from there they journeyed and camped on the other side of the Arnon, which is in the wilderness that comes out of the border of the Amorites. For the Arnon is the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Therefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord, "Wahab and Suphah, and the wadis of the Arnon, and the slope of the wadis that extend to the site of Ar, and leans on the border of Moab." From there they continued to Beer. That is the well where the Lord said to Moshe, "Assemble the people that I might give them water." Then Israel sang this song, "Spring up, O well, sing to it." The well which the leaders sank, which the nobles of the people dug, with the scepter and with their staffs. And from the wilderness they continued to Matanah, and from Matanah to Nahaliel, and from Nahaliel to Bamot, and from Bamot to the valley that is at the land of Moab, at the top of Pisgah, which overlooks the wasteland. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through your land. We will not turn off into field or vineyard. We will not drink from wells. We will go up by the king's highway until we have passed through your border." But Sihon would not permit Israel to pass through his border. So Sihon gathered all his people and went out against Israel in the wilderness. And they came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. Then Israel struck him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Yabbok, as far as the sons of Ammon. For the border of the sons of Ammon was at Yazer. Israel took all these cities, and Israel lived in the cities of the Amorites, in Heshbon, and in all her villages. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, and they fought against the former king of Moab, and taken all his land as far as the Arnon. Therefore, those who use Proverbs say, "Come to Heshbon, let it be built." So let the city of Sihon be established. For a fire went forth from Heshbon, a flame out of the town of Sihon. It devoured Ar of Moab, the dominant heights of the Arnon. Woe to you, O Moab! You are ruined, O people of Chemosh. He has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to an Amorite king, Sihon. But we have cast them down. Heshbon is ruined as far as Dibon. We have laid waste even to Nophah, which reaches to Medeba. Thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites. Moshe sent a spy to Yazer, and there captured its villages and dispossessed the Amorites who were there. Then they turned and went up by the way of Bashan, and Og the king of Bashan went out with all his people for battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moshe, "Do not fear him, for I have given him into your hand and all his people and all his land, and you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon." So they killed him and his sons and all his people until there was no remnant left him, and they possessed the land. Then the sons of Israel journeyed and encamped in the plains of Moab beyond the Arden, opposite Jericho. Okay, so that is the passage that we're looking at today. Before we get started further, are there any questions or observations?
Okay, a heifer is a cow, right?
Yes, young okay. one.
Then why is it considered dirty, and why are you dirty for so long with this cow? So I'm curious.
Dirty?
Well, unclean. You're unclean if you touch it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that's a big, big discussion about this one.
So they had to bring it outside the camp like it's a dirt, like it's unclean, and they had to slay it.
Yep.
Not only that, but they sprinkled the blood 7 times mm-hmm. towards the front. I mean, everything's kind of different.
Yes. Well, it's different, yet it should sound similar in some regards to
some of the
cleansings.
And what is this, and this cedar wood, hyssop, and scarlet, does that have something to do with the Messiah?
The whole chapter does.
Okay.
It's a big, big hint.
Okay.
But this one in probably a big red underline, I guess would be a good way to put it.
Okay.
That this has to do with it. That's why I was mentioning Hebrews chapter 9 earlier.
Because it's kind of mentioned. I didn't even know about that.
It's mentioned in passing there, but. Okay. Can I take a look at it as okay. to why it's mentioned there?
And then, so even if the ashes were outside of the, everything's outside of the camp, like
yep.
he's an unclean animal, everything's just really in its heavy duty. It's
quarantine,
like you're unclean
big
for
time.
7 days, and oh, quarantine. Okay,
quarantine, big time.
Sense. Okay.
But okay. it cleanses everything. That's,
yeah, but
that's
even
the
if,
weird paradox
but
of
even
it.
If you're clean, you're still dirty from touching it.
You have to be clean to even touch it. And
yeah.
then you become unclean.
And then, yeah.
It's a lot of paradoxes here.
You have to find a lot of clean people to help you
be
take
interesting
care
to tickle it, yes. So I'm glad you observed that, because those are some very important observations as to why this is so bizarre and has befuddled people for quite a long time. Any other observations here before we get going? Any further? Yes.
I kind of got confused because they're talking about Aaron's death, and then they're going back. He's going backtrack. He's backtracking to all the cities that they actually did conquer. Some cities while they were in the 40 years in the wilderness, right?
Coming to the end of it,
right?
Because you know how it ends up. It ends up there. They're sitting
right
there across from Jericho, which
right.
you'll notice
Joshua.
Is right there at the end of it.
But so these. Cities that they conquered, like Sion, Sion, the king there.
Yeah, Amorites
right.
and those.
Was it after Aaron's death that they
this is a little bit out of order, but
yeah.
it's a really good reason as to why it's out of order in this place. Any other observations before we get going too much further?
Why did Aaron have to die on the mountain?
Why did Aaron have to die on the mountain? That's a good one, and it relates a bit to why Moshe was not allowed to go in. Related a little bit to that. Yes. So just got a.
And isn't it a female heifer? It's a red
heifer.
Female.
is a female. Yes.
Oh, it is heifer. So it's
a young, very young cow.
So that's speaking to the first to Christ, right? I think it's Christ is when he's young, he's sacrificed.
Hebrews 9 is a big hint here.
Why did God tell them to talk to a rock?
Talk to a rock.
So he told them to speak to the rock. Mm-hmm. But Aaron and Moses yelled at the people and then slammed the rock 2 times.
That's a very good observation. Yelled at the people and struck the rock. Yet, there were instructions earlier. You might remember when we talked about this before, about Massa and Meribah, how they keep showing up again and again. That's in Exodus 17. Well, and that being tied to a lot in Psalm 95 and Hebrews 3 and 4. Should be kind of giving you a little hint as to what the message they're getting at in Hebrews is all about, because you got discussions there in Hebrews 3 and 4, which starts then going into a conversation that goes into Hebrews 4, 5, and then continuing on until it really reaches a crescendo in Hebrews 9 and 10. All kind of talking about a very similar thing about what the Messiah was up to and what the Messiah's role in everything was. And a lot of it is prefigured in this. And a lot of the observations that she was bringing up about the strange sort of thing about, you know, this red heifer makes everybody unclean. And yet it also purifies a whole lot of stuff. So it's a very, very strange thing. And as you'll notice as you kind of look elsewhere in the Bible, that this heifer is also very important about setting up the tabernacle itself and purifying the tabernacle itself. So thus you have an interesting catch-22. How do you have a tabernacle really without the heifer?
So did Aaron and Moses have to die because it was a strong lesson for leaders?
Oh, I guess you could say it was a strong lesson, very, very strong lesson for leaders, because it really goes, and we'll get there when we discuss it, but it all has to do about what the Lord said to them. You did not acknowledge me as holy, as you did not acknowledge me as set apart. That's what that was all about. And kind of in reference to what Moshe said, and he said two things you observed there, you know, yelled at the people, but it's also about what he yelled at the people. He mentioned two things in particular as he's yelling at the people, and those two things are what the Lord said, hey, you did not regard me as holy, as set apart, as special in what is going on here. So, those, I guess, are kind of good previews before we go much further. Anything, other observations that we should probably look at? We can always get to them as we go through this, but
this about Aaron going up and dying when the Lord commanded him.
Ah, yes. Why did he go up there?
And yeah.
Why did he have to die?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we'll get to that and take a look, but it is looks like it's tied pretty closely to why Moshe was said you can't go in. And then, you know, died before they went in.
And Aaron's stripping of his clothing and given to Eleazar, I found that, well, humbling, we'll say, you know, and Aaron says nothing, so it's just, it's like Jesus being stripped of his clothing, too, in the crucifixion.
Yeah, in one sense, it looks like it's, you mentioned humbling, almost kind of looks like a bit of a purposeful humbling, a knocking down of someone, a peg. However, it was also a very important, you could say, talking about leadership, a good symbol of the passing of the baton. Very, very specific in that one of the things that's been a hallmark of our country for a long time, by the grace of God, it'll continue longer, but the peaceful transfer of power. And one of the things that's done that is that someone who's in office leaves office, and usually, you know, some sort of a symbolic, a passing of the torch, so to speak, from one administration to the next. In the sense that, you know, rather than a specific dynasty of leaders, you have one high priest purposely under command, taking off his garments and then giving it You know, yes, it's a son, but it is passing it along. He didn't have to die first. He died shortly thereafter, but it wasn't like he died and then it passed to his son. This was kind of a very good symbol that, hey, look, this is who the Lord has chosen to go forward with this. So any other observations? Yes.
Is this like, is this and has to do with the order of Melchizedek?
Ah, good observation.
And how does this pertain to Eliezer? It was Eliezer. And what's his name mean? Because I didn't look it up. And maybe think of Christ on the mountain with the three.
Interesting.
And then taking off the garment. Yeah, taking off the garments and passing the priesthood over to Messiah.
Well, one of the things related to the Melchizedek priesthood that can be a good preview for coming attractions that we'll get to here shortly is... there's been a lot of talk and a lot of discussion and searching and such for a red heifer as far as to kick things back into gear with any sort of temple or such like that. But your observation about the Melchizedek and its interaction with the Aaronic priesthood is a good sort of indication as to what do we do about death. As you might have noticed that the red heifer... here that's talking about that it is all about purifying from death. Well, people have lost sight of where the red heifer is for at least 2,000 years, and it may go on for even longer, but the question has come in the interim, well, what did you do during that time? Oh, what happens in that time? Are people just totally lost and it's no hope for it? And we'll get to that catch 22 of the cleanliness and uncleanliness related to the red heifer and the setting of the tabernacle. Because there's instructions here about getting the first red heifer, but what about the next one? And the next one after that? And the next one after that? So let's start first into our discussion. We're going back and taking a look at Numbers chapter 19. So... we've got some instructions here about what to do with this red heifer. Just kind of take a look at some of the specifics first of this, and then start kind of peeling back the layers and what is God trying to communicate here. And it's talking about, you got this heifer. Now, notice it in verse 3. You should give it to Eleazar the priest, and it shall be brought outside the camp and slaughtered in his presence. Okay, so you got those strange things. Well, outside the camp. Well, that's bizarre because it was talking about the tabernacle. This is where all the sacrifices go. That altar that's in the tabernacle, except for this one. This one, very particular. Oh, you specifically take this one outside the camp. And, you know, number two is talking about that it's slaughtered in his presence. And then as you go along throughout this, it keeps talking about that is, this thing has to be, this heifer, the red heifer, has to be offered by someone who is clean, purified. Yet, the action of doing it makes you unpurified. So that goes back to what I was saying, okay, it may work for the first time, but then the second one. The second heifer that came along in Israel's history doesn't specifically say when that happened, but according to God's instructions, it would have to be done by people who are purified by the first one. So if you have any sort of lapse in time after this is recorded, how then do you get another one? So then there was various ways, if you read through the Mishnah and the Talmud, they have some ideas as to how it is if you've had an interruption between one red heifer and the next, how you get one back into commission. Because that person has to have, you look through this thing here, no connection with a corpse whatsoever. Not in the same room of a corpse, you can't go over a grave, no connection with death whatsoever. So there was even an idea that was kicked around as you read through some of the rabbinic writings. Well, we have a place in the temple that's sequestered, we made sure there's no graves anywhere underneath it, and you basically keep kids in there, have them grow up to the time of when they are old enough to be a priest, and then they're able to offer the red heifer. Well, that's a lot of ifs. If, and plus the kid cannot leave this compound. You're basically like, you know, a prisoner in this compound for that certain amount of time. So that brings out the great conundrum of this. Yes?
Now, does this has to do with the third and the seventh?
Well, the third and seventh day is for the person who is defiled by a corpse or something.
Yeah, but that the third and the seventh day to me makes me think about when Christ came in the middle, and then the end, the seventh.
Yeah, well, three and seven are important dates, especially related to death and resurrection and the final coming of the kingdom. But the thing, though, in God's instructions, well, this, when you have death, death has to be purified. It has to be purified if you want to come into God's presence, yet without having someone purified and without having the heifer, you can't do it. So you end up in a catch-22 going forward. But she mentioned something very interesting. Melchizedek priesthood. What do we learn from, you know, both the Psalms and Hebrews, the book of Hebrews there, about the Melchizedek priesthood? Everlasting, always purified. So, that's one of these pictures of, and again, what was the instruction that was given before the tabernacle was built back in Exodus? You might remember what God said to Moshe about building this. Do it after the pattern that you saw in the heaven. It's a pattern of the original. It's not like some translations say mere copy, just it's only a copy, something to knock it down a little bit. These are representations of what's going on. You wouldn't say, oh, it's merely a wedding anniversary. Try that with, you know, with someone. See how that goes. Oh, it's merely, you know, merely a remembrance, merely this, merely that. No, it's hugely important. You don't get the meaning from your memorial. You remember the meaning in the memorial. That's what the offerings have always been. That's what they always would be. So it was somebody that brought up a question this week about, well, there's a lot of talk in Ezekiel and in the prophets about a eventual king, an eventual temple called the Third Temple in the time of the Messianic era. Well, what would that be for? Since we've got the original. It would be what it always was for. It was always for a reminder. Always. It never did anything by itself. Never did or solved anything by itself. It's kind of what one of those things that you see brought up in, you know, Psalm 51, when David is reflecting upon this. You don't desire the blood of bulls and goats, otherwise I'd bring them. And you see in Isaiah chapter 1, where he's going on about God eventually says, you know, I hate your feasts. Even though these are talking about the memorials and such that God himself had told them to do. Because the feasts and the offerings were nothing in and of themselves other than patterns of something original. And that thing that was original being the Messiah who was coming. So thus, just like with the Melchizedek priesthood, having something that would continue on, when you have death, and what do you do about death? Death purified the way it's always been purified, and that's through God himself, and specifically through the death, resurrection of the Messiah. So getting to that, because it's a very important point of what this is all about. Now, a couple of things you might notice. Some people throughout the years have kind of grouped what you would say. It seems kind of odd that when you read through the Torah, you'll see like, oh, if you touch this, then you become unclean. If this touches that, well, if this doesn't touch that, then it's not unclean or it's clean, and it goes on. But you can, it sort of, try to group them into sort of maybe say like four or five different groups of what they call it. It's often referred to as like the father of the father of you could say impurity or corruption or something like that. So basically the grandfather of it. and it, that is corpse, death. So the mother of all corruptions, the father of all impurities or whatever, death. Because when you read through the word and the Torah, this will transfer to everything. This, you could say, a thing, this pallor that's come in between your connection with God. Because remember when we were going through Leviticus, the whole thing of what offering or korban, the korbanot, or translated offering, what that was all about was it was like you are being brought near to God. These were kind of representing you coming near to God. And God saying, just so you're talking about, a quarantine of the world and its death and rebellion against God away from God's presence. But God wants to live in the midst of people and wants to be near them. So how do you bridge that gap? And that's what the picture, the pattern of the korbanot, the offerings were all about, was about coming near. Well, death, the stain of death was, you're supposed to get that message throughout all this, that even being in the same house or same room as a corpse or something is, it's not like it's going to something jump off you. Okay, now we know in the realm of microbes and stuff like this, you might start getting into a different realm, but the message here is that death is not natural, even though we might in our world think everything dies, this dies, that dies, things decay, they fall down, car stops working. We call it the second law of thermodynamics. Things run down. Well, one of these things that we should note in here is what is the last thing you see at the end of Revelation? Revelation 21 talks about death and the grave being thrown in to the lake of fire. Hallelujah. So, yes, this whole thing right here, the ultimate corruption, the ultimate stain that's in between God and mankind. That's right. And it may seem strange, just like with the weird paradox you see with the red heifer, that the tabernacle, even though you see all kinds of offerings and sacrifices and burning up this and burning up that, it's all about life. The life giver, the presence of the life giver being there, you're coming through in the symbology of the korbanot, the offerings. You're not coming through there for death. You're coming there for life because you want to get closer to the life giver. So from death, then you've got to get the, what's often called then the, so you got the grandfather of impurity, and then you got like the father of impurity. And those are kind of like the subset of corpse, even being in the room around it. But the second level, you might say, is the things that just by touching it. And then you see it's kind of listed in there. And a lot of things just have something to do with, you might say, you know, blood being a kind of a key thing of that, and some sort of discharge, something nasty and icky. Now, roughly something in the... Hello, I can't even spell. All right, you get the idea. Hello. Yes. Yes, this is what I do for a living. Hello. I know. Can't live without spell check. Yes. So, these are kind of things, and you read through the word about some sort of issuance of blood or somebody with an issuance of blood or somebody of a discharge or something or other, that that by touching it is something that transfers it here. So, one of those things that we get through the grandfather of impurity with death not being something that is natural, something that God doesn't want in the order of things. And as we see throughout the word, something he's ultimately going to deal with and get rid of with the death, disease, corruption and stuff that we see around us every day. So we get used to it. Thankfully, God has not gotten used to it. And through his word, he kind of advises us to not get used to it, to not fear it, but not get used to it, because this is not the way things should be. with not the way they're going to be. So that's, and then with the thing about touching some sort of impurity is that with blood, the symbology of blood kind of goes back to Genesis and chapter 6 and such, where it's talking about with Noah and talks about with the first offerings and the thing of animals killing each other and such is, and animals killing people is about blood and blood being a symbol of life and life is in the blood. So the symbol of blood being lost and things oozing or whatever, you want to go far as that. Even if you might say it's in the, quote, natural realm of things. Still something that is kind of moves things off. And then that goes into, you'd say, maybe the first, often called, kind of call like the first order impurity. And that's like somebody ends up being contacted by one, either the corpse or the blood or discharge or something like that, and then you end up with it yourself, and you may, you know, people may not want to get near you. And then you've got the second order of the impurity, and that is things that are touched, but they don't kind of transfer it off to yourself. So, the point of all this is the lesson in all of this, as you see in all these various levels of impurity being transferred and not transferred and such, is we should get a lesson of how much death and the way that things have gone away from the way God has created it, how far that stretches. Because, you know, we maybe don't think anything of it. We waltz into a cemetery. We go to a funeral where they have the corpse in there. You know, for us, maybe doesn't really matter much to it. But, you know, you think of in some traditions where it is a, you know, seen as something incredibly important that you avoid it. You know, some spiritual leaders will avoid this as much as they possibly can, but you can't avoid it all the time. So you may have people that won't go to a cemetery or won't go to a funeral or anything like that because they're looking to avoid that. For those kinds of people, the cognizance of how much death and decay and such around us, that's very present in there because you're always looking to avoid it. It's one of the other lessons of the clean and unclean, because we're talking about unclean in here and kind of impure. Another thing to point out in this is that when it's talking about impurity here, this is not talking about something that is unclean in and of itself. It is about that it's something that you just don't waltz into God's presence with. And that's like the realm of childbirth, where you got flows of blood. It's not saying there's any kind of sin or guilt or anything else like that. It's just like death happens in a death-ruled world. Things happen and people are born. You know, you have sicknesses, disease, no fault of your own whatsoever. But it's just, that's a symbology of decay. So, all this is saying that God's realm about life, not about death. So all this in kind of a preface to get back into Numbers chapter 19 here, talking about this red heifer and what you have to do with the red heifer. It has to be very strange. You take it outside the camp. But you have to purify the sanctuary with it. So with, just like with the Melchizedek, always continuing on eternal, thus our, quote, eternal red heifer in the Messiah Yeshua, always there to purify us from death. And when we talk about, and when we'll be getting into John chapter 3 in a moment because it makes a very important point about this. But when we're talking about putting our trust in Yeshua as the Messiah, the one who's anointed, our Savior, saving us from death. And it's kind of interesting because and in a world that kind of gets farther and farther away of what the reason why things die, and you get this sense in the secular world that, oh, death is not great. It's not pleasant. People die and such. Some people will go very far into the realm of, we call it nihilism, where they're obsessed about death and be very focused and absorbed in the macabre of death, the horror of death, and love to just look death in the eye and wallow in the sense of hopelessness and loss that comes with death. But in the realm, in God's realm, it's like, no, when you look in the beginning, life, it was supposed to be something that would continue on. And death was something when Adam and Eve, Eve was deceived and Adam decided to diverge and look for knowledge of life and death from somewhere besides the life giver, that doesn't go so well. So when we get back to looking at our eternal red heifer, we'll start seeing a lot of parallels. And we'll get to that as we read through Hebrews chapter 9, and you'll see what this connection is of what the red heifer did in its original context. It cleansed, it purified of this, quote, stain, unquote, of death, this death lingering around the place where God lives. And anybody who came in connection with anything that was dying would be purified from that. Not like there's, again, any sort of thing that happens when you're just walking over a gravesite, anything physical that happens, but it's just the recognition that you're entering a realm of, you might say, the twilight zone. It's quite different from how things really should be. So, with this, we talk about mentioning here about the the mentioning of the 3 days and the third day and the seventh day. So again, this is a 7-day purification process from being in contact with a corpse or under the roof of a corpse or something like that. 7 days to bring it out of that. Now, 7 is, you might recall, being a number that talks about completion, things that reach a completion of that. And we get the first pattern of that in the 7 days of creation, 6 days plus the day of rest, and that being encapsulated of a complete work that God has done. And the memorial on every seventh day of the Creator and the Healer and the Redeemer, a lot of different layers that are put on of the roles of God that are remembered on the seventh day. And you'll notice when you look through the calendar of Israel, you'll see lots of things that happen to do with 7. And in the 7th month, there are a lot of memorials that happen starting from the first day of the 7th month with the Day of Trumpets to the 10th day of the 7th month with Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the Day of Coverings. And then there in the 15th to the 21st day of the 7th month with Sukkot or Tabernacles, which is 7 days long plus a day on the end of it. The 777 thing around here is a message that God is doing something and bringing it a work to completion. This is not like God just started things out, put an ellipsis in it, and then went on vacation. This is a work that is huge scope throughout time, but it has a beginning and it has an end. So we may scroll to the end of the book and take a look there and see what happens, but it's important of what happens in between. What is it that God is doing in the transforming? Go from death to life. And that's when we talk about a shadow of the Messiah, an important picture pointing forward. Red heifer is a key one in that, because it is like the Day of Atonement, where it is only the high priest in there doing this. The heifer here is like another little thing that's screaming out, you can't do this on your own. And especially after the first one, it was enacted that we read here in Numbers 19. If you have a break and you don't have another heifer, good luck. Good luck going through with the sacrifice. Even if you find it and it happens to be perfect by somebody's one standard or another, good luck doing that, having the person who is clean, purified, who can then offer it. You can't get there from there. It's kind of like, you know, a building that starts on the second floor with no first floor. So,
how many of
them have sacrificed? Well, one. And according to tradition, there's only been 9 ever. And when you see various accounts of it, how much they use, we're talking like a pinch of whatever into like a giant vat or whatever they would use for a mikvah, or you know, we call it baptism, to purify somebody through that. So that's one of those pictures of there supposedly haven't been many of them, and they would keep the ashes around for a long, long, long time. But as you'll notice, people have been looking for another one. They don't know where any ashes of the last one still are.
There is a red heifer available today,
though. Good luck putting it into commission.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's like the whole world is dirty and we're unclean and there's just no help except for the Lord. But the verse that's number 21 in chapter 19, it shall be perpetual statute. So, I mean, it's supposed to go on and on and on and eternally, from what I understand.
That's right. That's why the observation, you know, connection with the Melchizedek priesthood is so important. That this work of purifying from death has been going on, you could probably say, like the lamb that was slain from the foundations of the earth. This is like the red heifer that was slain from the foundations of the earth. This work of purifying, cleansing the world from death has been happening ever since the first death in the world. And will continue on down through the last death that ever happens in the world. So, with this, we see like in the symbols of the third day. It's talking about on the third day is when you started. So imagine this. Okay, you had some sort of contact with a corpse of some degree, whether it's in the ground or in your house, or you actually touch it yourself, because that's a part. Somebody has to do it. Somebody has to work with the body, because that's actually one of those commands that God says. You take care of a body. That's what you have to do. So it's like, what is God condemning someone to death? Is someone has to do it? Or is this a point of saying, look, you cannot cleanse yourself from death. I am going to send the way that the cleansing from death happens. Now you notice that in this case, in the beginning part, it's the authority that God tells Moshe to then tell his son Eleazar. But Eleazar isn't actually the one who actually does it. It just says somebody killed it. So some people have thought that, well, you know, maybe according to tradition, Moshe himself was the one who killed it, because he was under direct authority, because who else was actually clean by that time? Nobody. So thus, when you try to put another heifer in a commission, well, I tread lightly on the God told me to do it thing. That doesn't work often well. But one of the pictures that we have of you start in the third day of the cleansing. Well, what is one of the great things that we get about the resurrection? That's where you have death holds no hold on you. Death has lost its sting. Because of what? The death of the Messiah, or the raising of the Messiah? The raising of the Messiah. So, the picture of the heifer being taken outside of the camp. Yeshua was taken outside of the city. Yeah, a lot of people wonder, well, you know, what is this about Passover? You know, Passover is supposed to happen in the temple there. But one of those little things that might slip your mind is when in John, where it talks about that they went up to Passover and people were purifying themselves. Yeah, what do you think they were purifying themselves with? Just a mikvah? It's if you had any contact with any dead whatsoever, you could not celebrate Passover. Not at all. So, what was more important? Well, I shouldn't say what was more important. There's a whole lot of levels of different symbols that are going on here. He's the Passover lamb. He's the red heifer cleansing from death. All these things. He's the first fruits. Yeah, he's the unleavened bread. On and on and on it goes. But that's one of the key things that we have here is death had to be conquered. So the third day and then the 7 days, you just have a great picture that it is complete. It's complete. Well, you can kind of, you want your 7,000 years. Well, yes. But one of the key things that we should get out of this is that it just reaches completion. So that's where you start with, to begin with. Yes, okay, we have another question back here.
So what does, where are we at?
Numbers chapter 19?
Yeah. Okay. What is the cedar wood, the hyssop, and the scarlet
great.
All about?
Great. Glad you reminded me of that one. Okay. Cedar wood, kind of a refresher from Leviticus again. Cedar wood, what do we know about cedar? If you have a cedar box, it doesn't do what?
Moss.
It's kind of like a natural way. It smells great, and it keeps things from decaying, bugs getting in and ripping up, chewing up your stuff. So you can see it is a way of, you could say, purifying, blocking, cleansing. Plus, it's red colored. It's like the redwood of the Middle East. So, yeah. So, one of those great things that you have in there is a great, perfect thing to take a look and see what you have of that blood color. Plus, hyssop. What things do we have about hyssop? You might remember hyssop from Passover. So, yeah, hyssop on the cross. You see in the Psalms it says, purify me with hyssop and I'll be clean. Yeah. Yes, hyssop is what they would baptizo into the blood of the lamb and then paint the doorpost there on the first Passover there. And it was also used in there in purifying the priesthood as well. So hyssop has, you know, people who are more into natural pathic approaches can testify more to this, but hyssop does have the kind of, you know, say, anti-boogie characteristics to it as well. A little bit of a cleansing hyssop oil as well. But then you have in there the scarlet yarn. Again, something that's red. So you got red with the cedar, you got red with the blood of the red heifer, that the heifer itself is red. And then you've got the scarlet yarn. And by tradition, they would say, we actually can get it from a earlier passage in Leviticus, where it's kind of the idea that you tie all this stuff together. It's like a bundle. And then you throw it in. It's like a fire log. But it's a great symbol of a package of preservation. Various symbols in there of preservation of life and whatever being thrown into this fire on top of where the heifer is burning. So multiple symbols are going on here about preservation, life of blood, which is also life in there. So that I don't know if that helps with that picture of what those symbols are. Does that help at all with that? Of why those are in there. Those are symbols of, you could say, purification, preservation, prevention. Now,
but it's more of a symbol.
Well, yes. I mean, they have physical characteristics that do those things, but they in and of themselves don't do anything with the problem of death. I mean, corpse is already there. It's not like something has jumped off the corpse and gotten on you. It's the pallor of death in the world and your connection to that pallor of death. That's something that God wants to move away from the picture. So we go through here on what you do with the cleansing of the person, sprinkling, and then on the third day and on the seventh day. So the third day, kind of a nice picture of something that you do as a picture of new life. You might remember from the sacrifices that when the priesthood were to eat of an offering, they had to make sure that they did it, nothing left over on the third day, because if that was so, that would start be considered to be rotting. So that's why you have no unleavened bread with those sacrifices. No leavened bread, sorry, except for Shavuot, of the guilt offering and the sin offering and such, and you don't have any rotting stuff around the tabernacle, because the tabernacle is supposed to be like this embassy of life in a world of death. So thus, you don't want things rotting. You don't want things that are souring inside the tabernacle. So those pictures of life versus death. So now it's time for the Haftarah. The normal Haftarah for this is over in Judges 11. Might touch on that if we have a little bit of time, but the main Haftarah Haftarah is just a word that means like a parallel passage. It literally means to divert, but it just means to take a look at something, another picture of this. So the passage we're going to look at is actually Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9 is a great Haftarah for Numbers chapter 11, as specifically mentions the heifer in it, but it puts it into the context of what it was all about, what it always is supposed to mean, and also what is continuing to happen with this pallor of death in the world and what God is doing about it. Now even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary, for there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, in which there was a lampstand and the table and the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. Behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle, which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna, and Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. But of these things we cannot speak of in detail. Now when these things had been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle performing the divine worship. But into the second, only the high priest enters once a year, not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. The Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol of the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of Reformation. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of bulls and goats, but through his own blood. He entered the holy place once and for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. For this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the internal inheritance. For where a covenant is, there must of necessity be a death of the one who made it. For a covenant is only valid when men are dead, for it is never enforced while the one who made it lives. Therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment has been spoken by Moshe to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." And in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and the vessel of the ministry of the blood. And according to the law, one may almost say, all things are cleansed with blood. Without shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Nor was it that he would offer himself often, as the high priest enters the holy place year by year with blood that is not his own. Otherwise, he would have need to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now once, at the consummation of all the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And insomuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him. Amen. So, that gives a little bit of a better picture of where the heifer fits in there. And it gives a little bit of a picture in there of why the heifer is so related to death, and why the heifer is connected to the work of Messiah. Talked in there about, you know, the one party of the contract, you know, to discharge it has to die. Paul goes into greater detail in Romans and I think it's like what, 5 through 8. And yeah, kind of chapters 5 through 8 kind of builds on this idea of the covenant. He uses the picture of like marriage, and people were married, you know, once one party dies, then the marriage contract is canceled, and then the other person can go on. This being a picture of our old life under our old contract, or you could say, our deal with the devil, you might call it, our deal with death, you know, which started from the garden, and just trying to find the answer to good and evil and life and death, really, in some other source besides God. That deal to redeem us out of it is like, okay, that party has to die. So that's one of these pictures that we get often. Messiah is always talking about, you know, take up your cross daily. It's about your old life has to die, and you have to decide every day. You know, if you talk to anybody who's been struggling and God is giving the victory on some sort of substance or behavioral or whatever problem, that is a decision daily, and sometimes many, many, many times a day that you have to make, that old life has got to die. That old way of doing things has got to die for you to move forward. So it's kind of sad that more of us don't get that picture of that real struggle that we're in. We see it around us all the time, and we think really nothing of it, but how alien it is to the order that God has created. So that's one of the great pictures of the red heifer, is to take us out of that, to even make it possible to move back into what they call the tabernacle, that is the place where God dwells with mankind. So that is the great picture of when it says that God wants to dwell among mankind. We read about that several times so far in the Torah so far, and that's why the tabernacle smack dab right into the middle of the camp of Israel. And then when you read Revelation in chapter 22, we get the seventh day of it, the great completion of that whole thing is where the dwelling of God is now with men. And there is no more death. Death is gone. You get that picture that we see at the end, is that death is gone, God is dwelling with mankind, and it's all because of what the red heifer is a copy of, which is the work that the Messiah was planning to do, did do, has done, and continuing to do. Because it's one of those things, just like in all time, we deal with death and its lingering consequences and things that happen with it all the time. And we constantly need to get purified all the time from this old world. That, yeah.
Is this his perpetual covenant with us? Is it
perpetual covenant. Yes. Yes, Yeshua's work on the cross is his perpetual covenant for us. So it's one of those things where you talk about the copies meeting the ultimate fulfillment of them. Now, it's interesting you mentioned that on the cross, because, wow, we get into another section here. It's actually the next chapter, in Numbers chapter 20, where we meet another, yes, the bronze snake on the pole. So here we have the red heifer. We just read about what that copy was all about, and it's what that, you could say that's a memorial, because every time you're going through that ceremony of it, you're reminding yourself of what it is that God is doing, or you should be getting the idea that God is the one who's purifying you from death, to taking you out of this world of death into a world of life. Should get that picture. You know, throughout Israel's history, that the disconnect often happened. And you read about that in the prophets, where people just went through the motions of it and they lost track of what it all meant, and it just became something you did until God just had to come over there and bash them on the head a few times as a little bit of a correction. Finally, the exiles being a correction of, hey, what is this all about? So, into Numbers chapter 20 for the next picture that we're looking at. So in this, we got the account of, I guess actually we'd be into, I'll first go over these deaths of these various people, then in 21 we'll get to the bronze serpent. But the death of, aha, okay. Speaking to the rock. Okay. Right. Right. Why do they have to speak to a rock? You know, it's not like we're thanking the universe for bringing us into existence and keeping us breathing and all that kind of thing. Well, in the realm of God, who's the creator of all things, you know, is the rock going to give you anything just by talking to it, by in and of itself? No, rock isn't going to do a thing. You know, just like, and that kind of brought up in the prophets, you know, you take this piece of wood or you take this piece of metal and you carve it or you mold it and you make something out of it and then you bow yourself down to it. Well, you can also burn it in the fire and keep yourself warm. It, in and of itself, is not doing anything for you. So that rock was not the source of the water. God brought water from that rock, but the rock wasn't the source of the water. Nor even the staff, nor even Moshe hitting it with the staff eventually. Because I mentioned earlier, this Massah and Meribah keeps coming up in together, this being mentioned together. You get the first realm of that in the first seven verses of Exodus chapter 17, where these events are hugely pivotal. Because in Psalm 95, it mentions, you will not enter my rest. Do not contend with me like you did at Massah and Meribah. And those two things you see is kind of like bookends in the history of this wandering is Exodus 17. That's the first generation. Those are the ones that came out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt, and they're headed toward the land. Then the second generation is what we're reading here in Numbers chapter 20. And again, it's like two generations, the same, almost identical event happened. You know, you have people who are contending and it's like, give us water. You know, why did you lead us out here to die? Exodus 17 has got kind of the added real big in your face insult to God is like, you know, are you with us or not? That's one of those key things that pretty much doomed the first generation, because when they finally got up to the land and they sent the spies in and such, and they're like, you know, we can't do it. Well, yeah, they couldn't, but God could. But they didn't want to trust that God was actually going to go with them in there and take care of it. So he passed on them, and the second generation was going to go in. So here we are again with a point in time where we're getting up to almost the point where the second generation is going to be going in, and here you have it yet again of encountering this, encountering a rock and with water coming out of it.
You know, it just came to me that last week we talked about how the Lord said the iniquity of the high priest would take the iniquity of the people.
Yes.
And in this case, Aaron died and Moses wasn't let in the land. I mean, maybe it was part of that whole thing of rebellion again that the PE took on the problem.
Ah, okay. Well, let's go further into what it was that's actually happening here. So we see in verse 8 of chapter 20, the Lord said to Moshe, take the rod, you and your brother Aharon, assemble the congregation. So taking this rod, now take the rod. Which the rod is this? Most likely, take the rod and assemble the people and speak to the rock before their eyes that it may yield its water. For thus you shall bring forth water of the rock and let the congregations and the beasts drink. So, it kind of emphasizes, which rod this is, verse 9. So Moshe took the rod from before the Lord. Well, you know, we had just read there in Hebrews where that rod was. The rod was there in the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Testimony, before the Lord. And so, remember just a little bit before about what the rod and the budding was all about. That was, again, challenging it, is like, well, who's really the one speaking here? Is it just, you know, Moshe and Aharon just kind of spouting stuff off? Who is this Lord? Does the Lord exist or what? And the whole point of the budding of the rod was to show, yeah, this is the anointed of the Lord. This is the one who the Lord is actually speaking through. This is the Mashiach of the Lord here for this mission. Was Aharon. And so taking this rod out again. So you imagine the symbolism of it, because it had gone into the Ark of the Covenant. And like we read there in Hebrews, people just didn't waltz into the Ark of the Covenant and just lift the lid and check on what's stuff going on there all the time. No, didn't do that at all. So to see that again, it's like, whoa, we saw that once before and a whole lot of people died. As a judgment for this. So, in a sense, it's like you're almost, it's a little, oh, is this another judgment coming? But then, coming up, so he's got the rod there, and he's supposed to speak to the rock. And just, you know, rewind the tape back to Exodus 17. Okay, there he was to strike the rock. But this case, he was supposed to speak to the rock. So this was supposed to be, you've got one miracle he's holding right there in his hand. One miracle. And now he's going to convey another great supernatural thing, a God thing, by talking to a rock, and then water was going to come out. So But then one of the things that is said, Moshe says there, because you got Moshe and Aharon gathered them together. So it's important to note that the two of them gathered the people together. Both of them did. And Moshe said, "Listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you from out of the rock?" So, probably the most egregious one out of that is, "Shall we bring forth?" Because what is this thing that we've been hearing about ever since the Exodus? Is like, is the Lord with us? Is there really a Lord? Is he actually ever doing anything? And now he's like, he's saying, we, you know, Moshe and Aharon, are we, we're going to bring forth water out of this rock. And then I guess, you know, something else that could be objectionable as well as saying, you rebels. Because one of those things you could say is passing a judgment. You know, you, because remember the idea of rebellious, that's not just, you know, kind of deviating off the path. This is like in your face kind of opposition to God. And God had said that this second generation was going to go in. So kind of potentially a second level of offense there and saying, okay, the generation that God was going to bring in could be also rebellious against, or was actually rebellious against God. So, you know, the kind of the chief thing there is that we were doing it, the Moshe and Aharon. So, kind of, you might say that's kind of tight, and you might say, people might say that could be petty to rope Aharon into it when he didn't say anything. And you say that the whole golden calf thing was a whole lot more, you could say, egregious than that, because he was just standing there at this point. Yet there at the golden calf, he actually, it's described that he made it, or at least supervised the making of the golden calf. So the point being is that this is how the two of them got wrapped in there, and that's why it was so serious. You know, more than just, you know, disobeying what the Lord specifically said, you know, speak to it versus hit it, but then also try to divert where the otherness of the situation was coming from. Where was the water coming from? Was it coming from Moshe and his stick? Or was it coming from what God was doing with a source of water that shouldn't bring forth water? So I don't know if that helps a little bit in going toward how it is that you have Moshe and Aharon basically saying, okay, this is the end of line for both you guys. You're not going into the kingdom. And then with the death of their sister, that also bringing that whole family line to a close as far as they're going in. You see, their children went in, but they didn't. So that first generation, you know, except for two men that are mentioned in particular, I'm sure there were probably others, but two specific leaders that were mentioned of Joshua and Caleb, those two being leaders that were specifically of the first generation that did go in. And we had talked about that in a previous occasion, but their whole thing was, yeah, the Lord is with us. Let's go. Let's go now.
Joshua was from Judah, the southern kingdom, and Caleb was from Ephraim, the northern kingdom.
Yeah. Yeah, one from each side. So, you know, when you talk about you rebels, maybe that's even something that looks out even further than that. Because when you see the prophecy of the two sticks in Ezekiel 36, the two sticks in the Lord's hand, you know, those are talking about from both the north and the southern kingdoms. The northern kingdoms who rebelled big time against the Lord and were the first to go into exile and not known, didn't come back as a united group, probably they filtered back in perhaps after that and maybe into with Yehuda and the second exile when they came back from Babylon, Persia. but didn't come back as a cohesive unit. So we always talk about the 10 lost tribes, metaphorically and such, as those of the northern kingdom that didn't come back as a whole unit. So that, I might say this is kind of being a little bit out of order because of these things that are mentioned in this parasha really kind of fit with the, you could say, kind of, if you were to go with a chronological Bible, these would probably be near the end of Deuteronomy if you were to say things sequentially, because these are things, because it ends there just as they're coming up on Jericho, which is where Deuteronomy ends. And right with Joshua begins, they're going in to take Jericho. So, yeah. Yeah, but it's in order thematically. This is in order thematically because this is a whole lot of people, key figures of Israel died here. So there was like a big pallor of death. All these leaders just dying one after the other after the other in the way that this is accounted here. And also you had the picture we'll be getting to in Numbers 21 about this plague of the bronze serpent. The plague of the serpents that was cured with the bronze serpent. So there's a whole lot of death that is talked about here in this case. Death and, you might say, rejection. This is one of the pictures that we see in there with this in chapter 20 of having to go around Edom, which that whole detour set up the you could say, the argument that you see at the beginning of chapter 21 of Numbers that kind of led to the serpents coming through the camp and biting people. So this idea of death and rejection being a key theme, and also key theme in the picture of Messiah, is that even though the Messiah, Yeshua, being the key one who is going to deal with death, and that Israel will be the key through which all the world would be blessed as the way, the answer to the death that's coming onto the world, yet leadership ended up rejecting the source of life. And you see this is being pictured in Israel's history throughout time. You see a little bit later on when they rejected Moshe and Aharon on several occasions. They rejected God on several occasions. Later on, they rejected God big time and wanted a king, like just all the other nations around them. So this idea of death and rejection is a continual theme, but even in the midst of this, God is still has this plan and keeps working this plan in motion to save, to redeem, to bring life. So let's go on into chapter 21. So the beginning part of this, it goes in with this, they had to take the detour, and so they encounter the Canaanite king of Arad who lived in the Negev. You remember that these are like, the Edomites were relatives. You know,
yeah, going, that's what I was asking.
Yeah. Yes, Esau. So these are the sons of Jacob or Jacob, you know, coming up to meet the descendants of Esau or Edom. So they are, so this is kind of the family thing coming back together again. Kind of in the, you might remember that encounter with when Jacob was coming back and then Edom came out with this big army. Esau came out with a huge army to meet him. But in that case, it was quite different because Esau came out and embraced his brother, long-lost brother. But in this case, Edom did not embrace their long-lost, quote, brothers. They didn't even let them pass through. Didn't even let them, like, buy stuff coming through. Nothing. Just they had to go around the entire area. They even brought out an army to make sure that they did bypass the entire area. Yeah, kind of a rejection of your family, which is another picture of, you know, Israel's rejection of their one and only son, prefigured in the Messiah.
God remembers that rejection, and he uses it in some of the prophets later about Moab and the Ammonites. Or who's the other one? Moab and
Edom.
Edomites. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these nation names pop up a lot as really good, you know, lessons for us in what is actually going on and why these judgments come through. Because when you see, as they start coming into the land, one of the things that ends up becoming quite problematic for a number of people is, you know, man, this sure reeks of genocide. It sounds like genocide, just coming and wiping out whole areas of people. But one of the things you have to remember is that this is 400 years after the initial call was going to say that the initial prophecy of that he was first had given to Abraham, that he was going to bring them back to this land. And eventually later you see him talking about that the iniquity of the Canaanites, the Edomites, listed a bunch of different ites, groups of people, had not reached its full. So we don't quite get a full picture of what that means. We see some little small pictures throughout Israel's history, like of Balaam or Balaam, the prophet Balaam, who obviously knew something about the Lord, yet he wasn't a part of Israel. So there were some people who knew about the Lord, and the Lord was speaking to certain degrees, that were not a part of Israel, that were of these nations that they were going into. So we don't have a lot of record of what it was that God was doing, but we do get small little hints that God had sent people to talk to these nations long before this time period. But yeah, you know, was it, what was the reception? I mean, even the book of Job is about, you know, really a kind of a time period, perhaps parallel with Abraham's, of other nations that were not of Israel, what would become Israel. And yet, those people knew who God was, and they were talking about God's character and what God expects and this and this and that. So the knowledge of God was out there, and not just in Abraham's family, but how were people actually receiving this? Did they turn away from the direction that they were originally going in? Their ways going after deities and whatnot that were not the creator, had no actual power? Or were they going off to serve something else? And we get this picture here that God gave them quite a long time to work that out. I mean, think in this country, we're only about 35 years into our country. And so we're talking about 400 years. So kind of double the length of our country's time period in God actually letting things simmer, letting the culture simmer. Which direction is it going to go? Is it going to go toward God or so far away from God that they're, you know, throwing babies through flames to serve something else that's not even a deity? So that kind of shows you the direction they decided to go in. Not toward God, but quite a ways away from God. Which brings us back here to quite a regular refrain here in Numbers 21, verse 4. They set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. So they weren't allowed to take the shortcut through Edom, their long-lost relatives, but instead they had to track around their territory and come in through a different direction. And the people became impatient. So this is the second generation. They became impatient because of the journey. It was taking too long. So not only did they complain about taking too long, verse 5, the people spoke against God and Moshe, "Why have you brought us out of Mitzrayim to die in the wilderness?" Yeah, there it is again. It's the same thing. You go back and read Exodus 17, it's very similar. And we've heard it several times before. For there is no food, no water, and, oh, this is even worse. We have this miserable food. What do you think that miserable food was? Probably chief on the list was manna. That stuff that God just delivered every morning. And twice as much on the sixth day of the week. Miserable food. So it wasn't that, not only it's like, are we there yet? But they're like, and why do you keep giving us this stuff? We don't want it. We want, you know, they different list of things that they had on their wish list that they wanted to have, all kinds of tasty food and such.
Well, I can say.
Uh-oh.
and I know you can eat the same thing over and over again.
Yes,
but
I can.
But I get tired of it.
Yes.
Who wants to eat the same thing over and over? And then there's so many ways you can make chicken, right?
That's right.
You know, that's what I'm thinking is they're tired.
Tired of it.
You know, I was thinking about them, that verse, they're like children. Children do that. They you know, their behavior is indicative of how a child behaves. You know, are we here yet? And you know, God is training them up, right?
So, yeah. Well, I mean, we do that quite a lot. We do that, I mean, quite often. When you think of it as their journey to the land, this is the second generation, and it's like their parents... Yeah, well, it taught them well how to complain. Their parents had started this thing out. They obviously, 40 years earlier. This is, wow, imagine that kind of a car trip. Are we there yet? So it's like one generation starts the journey and the next generation finishes it. It's like, wow, that's traffic. But one of those things to look at in this is that we, in our own lives, our journey through our own life, we're like, you know, for like, well, when is the Lord going to return? When is he going to show up? You know, I'm tired of it. This life is just too hard. There's too many troubles we got going on. You know, it's too difficult. You know, it's uncomfortable. It'd be so much easier. You know, you have to remember that why the Passover is so pivotal, because that picture of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, is really what Paul calls the old man, our old way of life. That was so much easier, you know. They didn't have the stuff about rules. Oh, that's bad. That, you know, leads to death and these dead works. Oh, that's just so inconvenient when I'm, you know, I just want to go off and go back to my old way of life again. It's a continual journey. It's a plague that comes in. And I was down to one thing is trusting God that this journey is as long as it needs to be. You know, whether our life is long or whether it's tragically short or mercifully short, depending on your perspective on things. And that perspective on things is truly what the big picture is all about, that transformation that we keep praying for and we look for God's Spirit to give us a new heart and a new spirit, that change in perspective, that we can truly be at rest. Because when the picture there in Psalm 95 and in Hebrews 3 and 4 of, you will not enter my rest. I swore my wrath, you will not enter my rest. It was all about not trusting where you're going, not being content with the journey that you're on. Not being at peace, at rest with where you're at. So that's why you see in Hebrews 4, it talks about the Sabbath rest that remains. Sabbath being a memorial of something that God is doing in us every day, giving us rest. That is a recurring memorial of it that we should just be coming around like, wow, thank God. He is the one who creates, the one who makes us holy, the one who sets us apart, the one who heals us, the one who brings us into a new life, into the new land, the new place that we should want to be in. And that's that change in perspective that happens throughout the whole 40 years. And sometimes it takes even longer than that if you start reading Joshua and Judges and going on further. Sometimes it took even longer than that. So... after they were, you know, bickering about this miserable food, It says, the Lord sent the fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many people died. So, this is a New American Standard, which tends to be somewhat literal in this. So that's why you got the fiery serpents, because the Hebrew word for that is the seraphim, which might sound familiar. Might think of some of the, you might hear about some heavenly creatures called the seraphim. Well, that's kind of the picture. I mean, literally, it just means because seraph means to basically to set something on fire. And so what? Yes, to set things on fire. Yes. Well, that is a very interesting thing, because when they talk about seraph, it's also about venom, and where you also get the picture of setting things on fire. That's why the picture that you have of the heavenly chamber, some people are thinking, well, these are flying snakes, flying fiery snakes. No, these are things that set, these are beings around the throne of God, the picture that we have of something that sets on fire, sets things ablaze.
As I recall, when Adam and Eve were ejected from the Garden of Eden, there was a fiery sword.
Yes.
An angel with a fiery sword set up there so they couldn't go back in.
Yes. So one of these great pictures that we have of the serpent is we get an interesting wordplay that's going on here with the serpent, which is Nahash. Nahash is the name for serpent in this. And the name for the bronze or the copper is Nechoshet, which you might sound, oh, that sounds familiar. Well, yes, it should, because they come from a very similar similar derivation of Nahash, which Nahash just means, it's actually kind of interesting Hebrew onomatopoeia, or meaning that the word sounds like what the sound is in that Nahash. It's about hissing. Nahash means to hiss. And you see it also used in other places about somebody who whispers, hearing whispers of an incantation. That's also uses the term of Nahash in that.
So if it's called Nahash, that's what they called the devil in the Garden of Eden in the Hebrew. So why would they want to stick the devil on a pole?
Ah, there we go again. Boy. There we go again. Why is it that we got the serpent on a pole? So, we have the picture here of these serpents, Nahash, slithering in, fiery, you know, they make, you know, your the wound get hot, and they're basically apparently venomous enough that they would likely die after being bitten. So, then the instruction is to take, it's interesting how it's firstly worded, it's that you take a seraph and put it on a pole. That's kind of an interesting picture. And then it mentions later that he took a nechoshet nachash and put it on this pole and then lifted that pole up. And then the people, after they've been bitten, they would live. So notice this. The serpents came in, they bit, people died. The Nechoshet Nahash up on the pole, this is a bronze, a reddish representation. Reddish, remember again, like cedar, scarlet, blood, life, was also a source of death. So that which brought death to the people is up on the pole, they look to it, and God would grant them life. So, you might start making your gears turn in your head a little bit about some things that the Apostle Paul observed. And he said, well, how is it that that which brought life or death to us can also be a source or a way to life? Because he's talking about the role of the words of God and such. Because the words in God condemn. They are a source of death. But at the whole thing of what the Torah is pointing to is the Messiah, which is the life giver. So thus, that gives you life. Which brings us to an interesting encounter that a member of the Sanhedrin, Nicodemus, had with Yeshua. It's recorded there in John chapter 3, one of the most memorized verses is a part of this account here. We're going to be taking a look at this from verse 4 through verse 21. Because in this, you'll see what it is that God was getting at with this serpent on the pole. So Nicodemus said to him, "How can a man be born when he is old? He cannot enter a second time to his mother's womb and be born, can he?" So Yeshua answered, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. Do not be amazed when I said to you, you must be born again. The wind blows where it wishes, and you hear the sound of it, but do not know where it comes from or where it is going. So is everyone who is born of the Spirit." Nicodemus said to him, "Well, how can these things be?" Yeshua answered and said to him, "Are you the teacher of Israel and you don't know these things? Truly, truly, I say to you, we speak of what we know and testify of what we have seen, and you do not accept our testimony. If I told you of earthly things and you do not believe, how will you believe when I tell you of heavenly things? No one has ascended into heaven but he who descended from heaven, the Son of Man. As Moshe lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, so that whoever believes in him have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. For God did not send the Son into the world to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. He who believes in him is not judged. He who does not believe has been judged already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. This is the judgment, that light has come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought by God." So one of those things, we had this picture where it's kind of Messiah is put this into very sharp focus, what the whole serpent on the pole was about. It's about life. It is about life, but it's interesting, it's about certain death and life, and the way to go through certain death to life. Kind of highlighting that condition where we started out here is that we are surrounded by death. We should get it into our heads that this is not the way it should be. It's the way that we're used to. It's the way that people tell us, this is the way it's supposed to be. No. The testimony of God is that this is not the way it should be. Not the way that things should work. So he gives us the way out of it. We kind of prefigured forward with the tabernacle. The only way that's put into commission is with the red heifer. And purifying from the death, both, you know, going into the tabernacle, had to encounter this red heifer in there. The picture in there, then we follow it up there with the bronze serpent, is that what seemed like would bring death to us actually brings life. Yes.
It seems to me that they had to believe in that serpent.
And
they did.
You have to. God is going to do something through this serpent.
Yeah, and so the parable to believing in Yeshua on the cross is the same thing. You know, you have to believe in him on the cross.
Yes.
For life.
Because one of the interesting things is, these people who were bitten, why were they bitten?
Because they were complaining.
Why were they complaining? They were sick of the food. They didn't trust.
They were not content.
Yes, man cannot live on man alone. It's like, what is the point of giving you the man? Is to God is keeping you alive on a journey. And it will end when God says it's going to end. Do you trust him that he's actually taking you somewhere, that the manna will keep coming, that the water will keep flowing? Do you actually trust him in this, that this is where it's going? That is why they were bitten. So after they were bitten, you want to talk about grace. After these people were under judgment, bitten by the snakes, dying, the pole goes up. Serpents are on the pole. God says, look to this and live. So they look to the serpent on the pole. They trust that's the way God is going to deal with it. And yep, that's how God dealt with it. They didn't die, but they lived.
So later on, and I can't remember exactly where, they find people actually have turned
yes.
the firing serpent into like a cult.
Yes.
And it's there, and I can't remember who. Somebody destroys it.
I think that's Hezekiah, wasn't
Hezekiah?
It? Or was it around that time period is where they...
Is that right?
I'm trying to remember. It was around that time period where they finally had to say, yeah, they had brought that thing in and you were using it as an idol to worship it. They had forgotten what the whole account was about, which was about, do we trust that God has taken us somewhere? Instead of saying, you're now putting your veneration into this thing. Either you're not worshiping this as some other deity, or that you're thinking that this bronze serpent in and of itself is bringing something out of it. Well, yes, I mean, that is, there have been various denominations and groups that have gone down that path, and you read in the Bible, it starts way from the very beginning where people put the emphasis on the wrong thing as being the source of salvation, when it is not. You know, when you have... Yes, well, the whole idea of fixating on things as being, you know, salvific when they're not is something that happens throughout time. When we talk about the abomination of desolation, when you look through Israel's history, that's happened several times. You know, Shiloh is one of them, where we get the term Ichabod or Ichavod. The glory is departed. Why did it depart? People didn't want to know who was actually had the glory there anymore. And, you know, they read about the practices and the worship of him became rote and wasn't actually focused on the one inside. That is something that happened throughout Israel's history, and the people of God have always had this problem. And when you look throughout the world, no matter what culture it is, you often fixate on things that you think are the source of the power. And you call them a deity, you make some sort of an object representing it, you make temples, you make ceremonies related to it, on and on it goes. When, what is it that actually is bringing the source of power? And you see that when it talks about that God gives a little measure of grace to everybody, you see, or measure of faith, you see that in a lot of cultures where they sort of kind of get that sense that their frame of beliefs are maybe not exactly the way things really work, and that there's something above that and beyond that, something that's not contained in this waterfall or this stone or this rock or this obelisk or whatever it is, that there's something else that's the actual creator of it all. And that's, thankfully, God has mercy on people through time. Mercy on the Canaanites for centuries. Mercy on Israelites for even many more centuries of their ups and downs on the roller coaster of trust in God. So, should be very thankful that God has that much mercy on us and our weaknesses and our wanderings and such. So, a great picture of what God is doing. So hopefully this passage here in John chapter 3 is kind of brought into focus what it is, especially with the bronze serpent, what that connection is, why that picture, when he told that to Nicodemus, when he's saying, when I tell you of earthly things, how can you get the heavenly things? Well, in a sense, that bronze serpent was another copy of the reality that the kingdom of God was doing and would do.
That would save them from death.
Yes, that would save them from death.
What I was going to say is I was reading Isaiah. I can't remember which part, but it kept talking about all the people sinning against God, but still he's going to have mercy and turn you back, and he's going to forgive you. And it was going on and on and on and on. And he kept saying, even though you're doing all this stuff, I'm going to have mercy, and I'm going to bring you back to me.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so precious.
Yeah.
And they were doing all this stuff.
Yep.
Sacrificing their children and doing all these horrible things. And he kept saying, I'm still going to have mercy, and I'm still going to bring you back home.
Yeah.
I mean, I was crying. It was like, so, what a beautiful mercy. That's mercy.
Yeah.
I mean, mercy.
Yeah, so when you see the picture that's mentioned in John chapter 3, it gives you a sense as Yeshua coming when it says, I did not come to judge the world. This source of, you could say, source of judgment, because judgment was given to the Messiah. This source of judgment, in this case, did not come as the life taker. You know, like with the serpents going into the camp, where he was the life giver. Now when you fast forward the tape and go down to Revelation, it's eventually you're going to reach a time where people just, after so long, people just do not want the ways of God. They don't want the kingdom. Even you see, like at the very end of Revelation, after, you know, the city of God comes down, they still war against God. Still war against God. And at that point, you know, all the, you know, does God exist? You know, which is the true God? All that becomes erased at that point. All those various things out there become erased. And then it's just, I don't want it. I don't want it. I want my old life back. I want the old way the world was back. Because at that point, it's going to become crystal clear to the whole world that what God says and the way God is the way it is. That is reality. And that reality is going to become, sadly, you know, very, you could say, not pleasant. Not pleasant for those who don't want to be a part of that. For those, you know, I don't know if, I know I used to be like that when I was younger, where it's like, you know, just charge hard in, live hard, that kind of thing. And eventually just realize after I saw some of my friends kind of flame out in that kind of a lifestyle, you realize that, yeah, okay, live hard, but that comes to an end at a certain point. At a certain point, the keg runs dry. At a certain point, the drugs run out. At a certain point, you run out of cash. Whatever it is, you get old, whatever. It ends at some point. So, do we... It ends and it leaves you a want. Do we want to live in a world where that's the character of God, as we see in John chapter 3 and expressed in Numbers 19 and Numbers 21, there of the God that's patient, the God that just keeps kind of nudging, sometimes nudging harder than we'd like, but still nudging us in the right direction. Do we want to live in that kind of world? And when we talk with our friends and families around us, is this the good news that we have to share? The good news of the kingdom of God? Is that the life of death doesn't have to be this way. This is strange in a world. So hopefully as we've come through all this, we've seen more than just strange things about a red young cow and a serpent on a pole. Hopefully what we'll see here is the heart of God that's being expressed. And sometimes you get the temptation, I know I've been tempted many times by this, and that's, well, why didn't God just come out and say it? What the red cow and the serpent on the pole and this and that and hyssop and all this stuff? But one of those things is that pictures, you know, we live in a very visual culture. We're always obsessed with video now. Well, one of these things that God is giving us are pictures of what it is, of the reality that's going. These are picture copies of it. So when we think of this, when you think of like the bronze serpent in your head, if you think of the red cow and all this stuff that's going on with that, it should be just focusing you even further on what it is and the lengths that God has had to go to in taking us from a world of death to a world of life. So, any last thoughts before we close out here? All right. Oh, yes.
So back to the rock.
Back to the rock.
Okay. When first time he struck the rock and water came out. And I've always sort of thought about that as Yeshua's crucifixion. He got struck, but the life-saving water came out. The second time when Moshe was supposed to speak to the rock, and he didn't, and that would be Yeshua's second coming, and he kind of broke the model. You know, there's the first time was the crucifixion, the second coming then would be different, but he broke the model.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's how I've thought about it, or I've heard it spoken. Have you ever?
Interesting.
That's why Moses, you know, one of the reasons why he didn't get to go into the land. I don't know.
Hmm.
Have you ever heard that?
I know. No, that's
the first coming and the second coming.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting way to look at that. Model broken by speaking to the rock versus striking the rock. Yeah. Possible. All right, well, let's close with prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us your words, and we thank you for having mercy on us. We thank you for putting up with us, even though we keep wandering this way and we get grumpy and tired. We lose focus, we get disheartened, we get tired of the journey. Father, we just thank you for taking us this far, and we thank you for promising us that you're going to take us all the way to completion. That this good work that you started in us, that you will take it to completion. We thank you in the name of your Son Yeshua, who's made this all possible. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info.